Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome everybody to a special episode of Cinema Royale. I am Travis Hobson of the Punch Drunk Critics, and on this episode, we're going to have a chance to listen to my interview with one of my all-time favorite directors, Danny Boyle. I had a chance to meet with him, along with a few others, and talk about his new film, Trainspotting 2, or should I say, T2 Trainspotting. Not a big fan of that title, but that's what it is, T2 Trainspotting, which comes 21 years after the seminal 1996 film that basically launched the careers of Ewan McGregor, Ewan Bremner, Robert Carlyle, and Johnny Lee Miller. There's no doubt about it. It did launch their careers. So let me set this up for a second here. So this was a roundtable interview, which is me and a few others. My friend Leslie Combamale, who you know, who has been on the show many times, a.k.a. the Cinema Siren. Eddie Paza from DC Filmdom. And I believe, and a few others were there as well. So you'll be hearing others besides me during this interview. Of course, I take the lead because that's what I always do. I'm selfish that way. But Danny Boyle was a great, it was great to talk to him. He's a great interview. I've talked to him before. The last time was, I think, 7 or 8 years ago for 127 hours. So it's been a while. It's been a while since I had a chance to talk to him. And it was great to talk to him about T2 Trainspotting. Because I wasn't a huge fan of the original film, but I loved this one. The sequel speaks to me a lot more than the original did. So it was good to have a chance to sit down and kind of pick his brain on what it was like getting everybody back together again and embarking on what was really his first sequel. He's never done a sequel before, and this is his first one. So enjoy this interview. It's about 18 minutes long, so I hope you enjoy it. Check it out.
So 20 years, man, 20 years between movies, man.
Yeah.
What was it like getting all those people together again, and how quickly did you guys kind of find that old rhythm from the original movie?
They found it very quickly, the actors. That really surprised me, because I don't know whether I was assuming it would be more difficult for them, or whether I'd underappreciated how much prep they'd done in their own minds, but they were right at it straight away. There was no, I was expecting kind of hesitancy and kind of ooh. They did feel that right at the early days. Are we sure we should do this? That kind of thinking,
yeah. You
know. But we felt like we were all in it together from the beginning. But then when they actually started, the rhythm was like. And we had I should have known, because we had a read through of the script about a year before we began, you know, to help us develop the script.
Mm-hmm.
And Johnny couldn't make it because of his TV show, but there were three of them there. And when I heard their voices again, you know, it felt very familiar. I mean, it's the same writer, you know, writing the dialogue as before, so it shouldn't have been a surprise, but it was. And for me, it was more. You know, you have that question of, do you copy the style of the first film? It's a decision you can make as a director, attempt to copy it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I won't do that. I'll let as much of it emerge as possible from the actors being in the room. So that's the main thing I copied from the first film in terms of directing, was to leave as many decisions as late as possible. Because I remember doing that on the first film. Because when you're doing something very stylized, it can go two ways. It can look like you've inserted the actors into it, and it's highly glossy style, and they move around in it and try and make their mark in it. Or you can let it kind of come out of the craziness of the characters.
Right.
And they are crazy characters. They're quite extreme. All four of them, in a way. I mean, Renton less so, but the other three are pretty extreme characters in a way. So I tried to get as much of it to come from them as possible. So that was my rhythm, finding my rhythm back through them. But they found it very quickly.
Anti-clockwise.
Okay.
You talked about improvisation as a director last night. And not in terms of the script, but
yes.
In terms of filming.
Yes.
I'm very interested to know, you also talked about happy accidents. Having had all of this experience from then to now, what sorts of examples were there in this film that were a result of happy accidents and not about planning? were there any like that you saw on screen or that happened kind of organically?
Well, what you do is you kind of, I mean, it doesn't make sense to the financiers or to the studio because you leave a camera. So for instance, in the scene that everybody loves, the No More Catholic sing-along, you leave a camera or two on Johnny Lee Miller at the piano. Now, Johnny can't really play the piano. I mean, he learned some very basic stuff. And that suits the character because he's like, he's remembering chords from school days, really. But you leave a camera on him for a day and a half, or two cameras. I mean, that makes no sense to the financiers. But what you get out of it is a moment, I don't know whether you remember it in the film, where he first sits down and he plays a chord and then he goes, nope.
Yeah.
Just fucking, it's not written. It's just fucking genius. And if you set it up, you probably wouldn't get that moment. It's probably because he's forgotten. It's probably Johnny thinking, fuck, no. Not the character. It's probably him going, no, they didn't say that. They said that one. You know, and you get...
That's perfect.
And you get things like that, which you can't justify to a financier, because the cost of leaving that camera on him for so long, you know, multiple takes, it's hidden in a plant pot or something. So he's even forgotten it's there. But what you get is you get these gems out of the actors. You and coincidences, and there's a lot of roughage and wastage because of that. You know, there's many, many times you don't get anything at all. But you do get those pure gems, and they're priceless, really. And they're worth $100 million, you know, for me. And you can get them, if you're canny, you can get them for under 20, you know, if you organise your crew the right way and go about it the right way. And also have very quick actors, because they, not so much that scene, because technically there's a lot to do in that scene, but most of the time they were very quick because they were up to speed so quickly, as I was just saying. Mm-hmm. So they buy you time, the actors, for little experiments like that. So it's stuff like that, really, which seems so inconsequential, but there is a delight when it when that moment happens. It's stuff like that, yeah.
That's what makes it great. Yeah.
I'm just wondering about sort of as someone who was born in '96 when Dream Johnny was actually.
Stop going on about it. Yeah.
I'm wondering about.
Had to bring it up, didn't you? Okay, no,
yeah,
it's fine.
I'm wondering about this connection, particularly with the sort of the revival of the monologue of Choose Life.
Yes.
Sort of this, you know, this introduction of several social media, several things,
yes,
that,
indeed,
you know, characterize sort of how youth lives today. And also wondering a little bit about Young Fathers, which is an incredible group, and just wondering how that came about, because
right,
their soundtrack to it just,
Well, Choose Life, obviously, when we started the process, everybody was like, great, the soundtrack's going to be great, yeah? And it's just like, well, hope so. No guarantees, but we hope so. And then they also said, you're going to update the Choose Life speech, presumably, they go, you know, like that. You go, oh, okay. Anyway, so we did update it because, and I think rightly so, because it is a kind of, it's a litany of addictions. And what he was mocking in the first film were bourgeois addictions, really, you know, the sofa, the washing machine, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And obviously, in 1996, there was no internet. You won't remember because you were only just born, as you reminded us. But there was no internet then. So that is obviously a huge game changer in terms of modern life and the way people live their lives. And so it felt good that a critic like Renton, and he is a critic in a way, should actually, a commentator, if you like, he's like an outsider who commentates, especially when he has a voiceover. It felt right that he should update it and kind of. But of course, he's doing it live. It's not a voiceover anymore. So he stumbles, I think, during it. And it becomes more confessional and more personal, because it's not a kind of like sardonic, cold eye on the world look. It's actually quite full of anger, you know. And his choices have not worked out, you know. And he's been left behind. So when he's mocking all that stuff, Facebook, fucking Twitter, Instagram your breakfast, it's partly because he's been left behind, you know. Very much, that happens to you. That's what happens. It's part of the process of the world, isn't it? Especially with the emphasis on youth in the world. So, in our world anyway, certainly in a commercial world. And so it's a very, I think, a really valuable speech. It starts off looking trendy and valuable, but actually becomes personal and valuable by the end, because he says, choose disappointment. Choose not becoming the person that you wanted to be. So he's beginning a kind of process by which he's getting his voice back again by doing that. Because that was why we robbed him of the voiceover at the beginning, so he wouldn't be the commentator, you know. He's a lot, he has to suddenly earn the right, you know, he has to speak to people, not just watch them and comment on it sardonically, not just withdraw, which is what he tended to do in the first film. But of course, because she then decides to sleep with him, he forgets everything he's learned, like middle-aged men would do. Young, beautiful girl. Hey, what's not to like? I'm just like, oh, I'm great. I'm back together again. And it's only by the end of the film that you begin to see, when she betrays him and leaves for her own reasons, you begin to see him actually go back to his father, hug his father, and he's beginning a process, I think, a proper process of atonement or, you know, rebuilding himself. Yeah.
Well, Dave, nice to talk to you once again. It's been about 7 years.
Really? Wow.
Yeah,
that's what happens. It's like you think, no, it hasn't. But of course it has. The calendar tells you it has. I know.
So you say that film is really about time, not just in the terms of how much time has passed since the original, but also how the characters have changed as they grow older. So I want to know, what do you mean by that? And also, what's the biggest thing you have to stay away from when it comes to making a sequel, not just for a film, but to a film that's become a classic after all these years?
Yeah, you obviously, it feels initially it's very daunting, and there is a part of you thinks we shouldn't touch it, but and we did touch it 10 years ago when we tried the other adaptation, and it was a good sign that we abandoned that, because it was an inadequate, an inferior idea even. Whereas this felt, as I said, it's felt, when John and I, the screenwriter and I, went back to it a couple of years ago, it felt more personal. We were more honest about ourselves and our own aging, and we were prepared to actually kind of allow it into the film more. And of course, that's what the actors responded to as well, because they are as well. And in their normal life, they don't admit it. You know, actors always used to try and hide their ages. You know, it's a common, it's part of being an actor. You kind of say, ah, I can play 25. Yeah, no worries, yeah. And speak French and ride a horse. You know, it's like, I am all things to all men. But now, of course, the internet's changed that. Everybody can chase you down and say, actually, you were born in 1996, as we know you were born there, as you've told us many times. It felt like, although you were returning to sacred ground, there was a reason that you could justify doing it. It felt like whether people like it or not, there was a reason for doing it that you could stand behind and say, well, if you didn't like it, I just haven't expressed it well enough. But this was the philosophy behind returning to these guys. And we all shared it, I think. We didn't coerce anybody into doing it. I think it was a joint decision that we all arrived at. I mean, I lead it, obviously, but it's a joint decision we all arrived at. Because nobody was paid a huge amount of money. It's not like we did that deliberately, because we didn't want people to do it for the wrong reasons, just because they needed some cash. In terms of their other careers, it wasn't a lot of money we paid them. And they do get more money at the back end if the film, you know, is successful profit-wise. But at the front end, not. Because we wanted everybody to commit to it for the same philosophical reasons. Yeah.
And the best part is, 20 years later, your careers have thrived since then, so that's amazing.
Yeah, no, we've all benefited from our work on that first film, hugely. And you feel a kind of obligation towards it because of that. So you don't want to dishonor it, nor do you want to use it to make the wrong kind of film. Either a cheap and easy, a too easy sequel, you know, that just rehashes it, or something that actually doesn't put you under the same kind of microscope as the first film. So I'm quite happy for it to be compared to the first film. And I mean, that was inbuilt, that we wanted it. We want you to actually know the first film, ideally. I don't know whether it works for people who were born in 1996 who might not have seen the original film, but those who have seen the film, that's who you make it for. That's, you know, that's who you want to kind of try and have a conversation with about it, because it's very unusual. I've never done anything like it before. Normally when you do these kind of press tours, you're introducing something foreign to people, something they're not familiar with, and you're kind of trying to ease their way into the film. But this way, you know, they know that they know the characters, and they already have an opinion about them, probably a suspicious one, thinking, is this a good idea? You know, so you know that's there as part of the equation of watching the film, and, you know, so it's, I welcome that, you know, so I welcome that.
Absolutely.
So.
I was privileged to go to Edinburgh for the first time last fall, and watching the film, I'm like, wow, I remember being there when they hiked Arthur's Seat, you know.
Yes.
So how much do you feel that Edinburgh itself play the character in this film.
Yes, it does, because although, I mean, you see little superficial details, like they've got a tram now, nobody uses the tram, they're obsessed about this, it costs £400 million, but nobody uses it, so when we asked permission, can we put Renton on the tram, they said, oh, please. Can you set the whole film on the tram? We'll make it available to you for the whole time. So they were delighted about that. But Edinburgh has changed, and it's two things. It's a much more it's a much younger city now, ironically, than it was. It's the clubs are packed. It's student town, and it wasn't when we made the first one. It was quite a kind of pristine, rather kind of slightly reserved city, rather middle class, bourgeoisie really town. Now it's full. A quarter of it apparently. Population-wise, is students.
Wow.
Some of them apparently drawn by the first film. It looks like this looks a good place to study. Let's go and study in Edinburgh. Anyway, and those students are from those students are from abroad and from home, and they've changed the tone. And the other thing that's changed the tone is the migrant labour, migrant workers from a lot of them from Eastern Europe have come into the tone, and they've changed the nature of the tone. And that's obviously reflected in the character of Veronica, really, as an ingredient in the city, you know, that's changed it. So yeah, the city does play, and then we got a chance to display the extraordinary beauty of the city as well on that day on Arthur's Seat, because we had a wonderful day. We were going to do it whether it was raining or shining, but it was shining, and you get to see this extraordinary national monument in a city that's both medieval and Georgian. It has two facades, both of which are preserved and historic, but it has this third natural feature, which is the whole town is built around Arthur's Seat. It just surrounds it like that, and it's like it's Cape Town or, you know, Rio de Janeiro. It's like, I mean, it's not on a lot of scales, but it is an extraordinary monument and a wonderful place to go for a day,
right,
for sure. Yeah.
Love it. 20 years since Trainspotting. I'm sorry. It changed the way I watch movies, and I know a lot of other people as well. Coming at it now, is the film meant to reflect not just the four boys growing up, but you as well?
Yeah, I think so. The other film is very exciting and crazy and bold and all those kind of things, but this is more thoughtful.
Mm-hmm.
It just is, you know. I mean, it just inevitably is. There's more space in it for thought and for a kind of dialogue with the film. So it's much more considered. That was chaotic and internal. I mean, if you think about the first film, there's no sense of place in the first film, apart from when they run down Princes Street. The rest of it, in fact, we shot the rest of it in Glasgow. And there's no sense of the outside world, because they're not interested in the outside world. They're just interested in the inside of their heads, basically. You know, and that, so you spend the whole film there, really. And so it is very surreal at times, and certainly very, very bold in its choices. And that boldness belongs to, I mean, the idea was to, when you try and make a film, you're trying to make the way it looks reflect what it is about, you know, form and content. They should be in tandem in some way. And of course, the first film is about being in your early mid-20s, and as a man, you don't care about anything, really. We're often accused of it, and quite rightly, it's reckless, carefree, you take huge risks. If you look back at some of the things you've done, you think, holy shit, how did I get away with that, you know? And so it's kind of, that's the nature of that film. And of course, the point about updating it, and not just pretending that they've just come back together again after a few years, but actually saying it, they're coming back together again after 20 years, which is a huge milestone in people's lives, is that it will be they will be different. They're the same, but they will be different. And that the film will be different as well. Of course it will be. So, yeah, I mean, as I said, you try and copy to some degree the first film in terms of decision making that they made in the room with the actors, but the actors are different than they were in that film. They didn't give a fuck about anything in that first film because it was a great job to get. Nobody had a career. It was like, what do we care? Well, yeah, I'll do that. Do you want me to stand outside there completely naked and pull a condom off my cock? Yeah, I'll do that. He's not going to do it now because you're kind of like, you know, they've got families and careers to worry about. But back then it was like, bah. So it's bound to be a bit like that, a bit unconsidered. This is a bit more thoughtful and inevitably a bit more mature. Although it tries to have its cake and eat it, you know, because you have the scene in the club and you have this chaotic scenes where they're kind of like trying to enjoy themselves. Kind of, it's a slight struggle because it's not quite as effortless as it was when you're in your early 20s, you know. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're just about out of time, but I got to ask,
You think there's enough there for one more movie in 2 years?
Yeah.
Gotta ask that question. Gotta end on that. What do you think?
No idea. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily... It's like the idea this time was 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's the idea that's important. It's that you have enough feeling that the idea is what you're going to make the film about. So it might be an idea that arrives in 2 years' time.
Right.
I don't know what that idea is. I can't think of it now. But so it's the idea that's most important, that it has a value about why you may not carry it off, but that's the reason you're going back to it, really.
All right.
All right, that was my interview with Danny Boyle talking about T2 Trainspotting. He seemed to be kind of leaving the door open for a third movie. I mean, hopefully they won't wait another 21 years. Although that would be kind of interesting to see these characters when they're like 60 or 70. Because hey, I would be 60 years old, so I would once again I'd probably be able to relate more to it than maybe even more than I do. T2, so who knows. But anyway, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Danny Boyle. It was a lot of fun, and thanks to him for sitting down to talk with me and the rest of the people that were with me. He's a great interviewer, as you just heard, very thoughtful. He knows what he's talking about. Stay tuned for another episode of Cinema Royale, a regular episode of Cinema Royale, coming up soon. I'm Travis Hobson. I'll talk to you later. Bye.